Welcome to Farcast. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. Terrific Farcast last week. We really appreciate the feedback we got from so many of our listeners. It really was very, very informative, and we learned a lot, certainly more about what was going on inside of Washington. But the best is yet to come. We have a terrific Farcast for you this evening. We cover, of course, Wall Street, Washington, and the world. And this week on the Farcast, we're going to go to Wall Street's, one of Wall Street's most senior and expert voices, my friend Stephen Weiss, who's chief investment officer at Short Hills Capital Partners. Then we're going to Dan Mahaffey from Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress as our Washington, D.C. senior political analyst for the Farcast. And then for the world, we're going to the Wells Fargo's chief economist, Jay Bryson, used to be the chief international economist, now the acting chief economist for all of Wells Fargo. I met him over 25 years ago when he was working for the Federal Reserve as an economist. Very smart guy. Can't wait to hear what he says. And by the way, he says this deal with Iran and the oil and the embargo, not a big deal as far as the economy is concerned. We're going to find out why. But first, remember that on the Farcast, we believe that money is hard to make. We believe that old-fashioned research, hard work, discipline, and patience are the keys to successful investing. And finally, we believe that emotion is the foe of the long-term investor. If you are fearful or ebullient, stop. Don't be giddy or sad and make investment decisions. Take a walk around the block. Get your wits about you. Be dispassionate and be disciplined. You'll save yourself a lot of pain and suffering. My friend Stephen Weiss, and I have known one another a long time. You have seen Steve regularly on CNBC. He's on the Halftime Report. He is the go-to guy, particularly when you need an experienced eye on what's happening in the markets. He's been doing this for over three decades. He's a lawyer with the, he's a past lawyer, maybe a reformed lawyer, chief investment officer, managing partner, Short Hills Capital Partners. He's the author of three books, The Billion Dollar Mistake, The Big Win, Learning from the Legends, and Unhedged, A Killing in the Market. These are terrific books too, and I commend them to you. He has his law degree from St. John's University. Hey, Steve Weiss, welcome to the Farcast.
Thanks so much, Michael, and thanks for the very kind words.
Every one of them. It is such a treat. You know, when we get to be on the set together, when CNBC is kind enough to have me up on your show, you always feel like the other voice of reason, or maybe you and I are the two nonsensical voices and everybody else makes sense. But I always find you a voice of reason on that set.
Well, thanks. And I find you as well. But I guess it comes from the fact that we've seen so many cycles, whereas actually the others on the show have seen it too. But every once in a while, you get some people coming on that only know bull markets, and any correction has been momentary. So, you know, there have definitely been periods that I've found very challenging where you can't get anything right. And like the first book, The Billion Dollar Mistake, when I was asked to write a book, I said, everybody writes a book that says, follow me and you'll make money. And I know that I learn more from my mistakes than from my wins. I just thought it was important to learn those mistakes. And I know you've got some of that same perspective. Trees don't always grow to the sky.
You're around long enough, you get perspective whether you want it or not, don't you?
Right. And you'd be on a lot more, except it'd be a very long commute from D.C. to New Jersey.
So, yeah, and they don't like me remote for the whole show either. That's kind of awkward, too. But listen, they're wonderful to have me on, and I appreciate it. Well, we had a great day in the markets today. New all-time highs for the S&P 500. What does that mean to you, Steve?
Well, it means that, number one, the markets knew I was doing this podcast with you, so they wanted to front-run that.
It's going to be a great day tomorrow, though, because Weiss was on tonight. Now, you got to know it, ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly. So we're getting a position. Look, I think we were grinding this way to begin with. there was a wall of worry that was built. That wall of worry is still out there. Everything is not coming up roses, but there's enough coming up roses, and the bar was set low enough in December where estimates came down for the S&P earnings dramatically that they were what we're seeing now are the beat of the resetting of expectations, and markets are more about expectations than anything else. So look, where else would you put money but in the U.S. markets? Europe has been doing okay, but growth there is very, very challenged.
Right.
We don't know when it's going to return, if it will return. Japan is always, demographics still terrible. Growth there is still terribly slow. China's picking up a little bit, but it's not a big market where everybody's going to invest in. So you're coming to the U.S. We have both the economy moving in the right direction and the markets. So tell me what we got wrong here, Steve,
because last time I was on on the show with you guys, there was a sentiment that was kind of articulated that and this was probably 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago where the sense was the Fed has killed the bull market. That extra rate hike did it, was the wooden dagger through the vampire's heart of all good things, and that we're not going to have the growth going forward and everything's going to hell. And I kind of argued against that, and I think you did a bit, saying, wait a minute, what just happened and why do we have this sudden change? But sentiment a month ago was horrible about, you know, the earnings recession and the profit margins were, for the S&P 500, were much, much too high, and they are high. But how has this market rallied in the face of that? And if Fred and Ethel are listening and looking at their 401ks at an S&P at 2933, what can they expect for the rest of the year after a melt-up like this? But first, so that's two questions. How did this happen in the face of all the negativity, and how were we so wrong? And then kind of what do you expect going forward?
So these markets are not like the markets that you and I grew up with.
No.
They're driven a lot by algorithmic traders. They're driven a lot by relative value traders. So in other words, if bonds move one way, these traders, and they have a lot of capital behind them with a lot of velocity behind it, then they think that equity is supposed to go the other way. So what happened was that the old tells in the market, meaning the 10-year, for example, got down to 2.4 yield. And observers are saying, wait, the bond people are somewhat smarter than equities.
Right.
If yields are trading down to 2.4, that must mean that the economy is weakening substantially. So that, on top of the lowering of estimates for a number of companies and the S&P overall by, going from earnings growth of more than 10% to an earnings contraction in the first quarter, created that fear factor. So I think I think one way to look at it, if you take out,
shouldn't we have expected some of that though? I mean, given that the tax cut was sort of episodic and that maybe the spending hasn't been, but I mean, at least the tax cut was, you know, you get the big one-time bump, and then I don't know. I didn't think that it seemed like more of a math problem and a math correction than it did, all of a sudden earnings erosion to me. Am I wrong?
Right. Well,
you can say I'm wrong. It's
so
okay.
Let's get rid of the bonds first.
Okay,
well,
go to
let's
bonds.
Let's get rid of the bonds first. So the bonds traded lower, or yields traded lower.
Yeah.
And bonds rallied because you have negative rates. Basically, everywhere else in the world, trillions of dollars negative rates. So what do they do? They're looking for return in our bond market. So bonds didn't rally and yields didn't go lower because of fear of a recession. They went lower because of demand for our yield in the deepest treasury market in the world.
Yes.
So let's get rid of that.
So it wasn't the fearful flight to safety. You're saying it was a flight from other countries that was opportunistic.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So there was some flight to safety, but that wasn't the delta. Now, the earnings, they came down because companies got cautious, not because the Fed raised in December. They got cautious because there was a spillover from China. They didn't know in terms of slowing the Chinese economy, which slowed dramatically.
Yes.
Europe continued to slow, and you have 40% of S&P earnings that come from outside the U.S.
Right.
And the commentary from CEOs were that things were slowing, and they were. Then China went through massive stimulation, and their economy started to pick up, and their market started to pick up, and CEOs became more comfortable with that and also seeing light at the end of the tunnel in terms of a resolution to the trade agreement. So there was less cautiousness. We still haven't seen the big CapEx spending that would put this market into hyperdrive, but we saw a little bit of it. So the market reset. If we didn't reset, and here's the question, if we didn't reset earnings estimates, would the market be at new highs? And I don't think would be because we would have underperformed expectations when the banks reported, when the companies that reported thus far have reported.
So the reset of expectations allowed us to beat the expectations and the market's going higher because we basically lowered expectations, you think?
Yes. And Apple's a good example.
Tell me.
If you take a look at Apple. So Apple, which I was on record as saying they're going to miss the quarter.
Yes.
And they did. And the stock traded down from over 200 down to, let's call it 150. I think it was 145.
Yep.
And then Tim Cook came out January 2nd and helped it go down when he pre-announced the quarter.
Right.
Then they come out and essentially pre-announced. And they then, put up an okay number. And the stock now is up, 40%, 30% from the lows?
Yeah, absolutely.
You look at NVIDIA. NVIDIA, the same thing. There's nothing that's happened with Apple that's gotten any better.
Right.
They're still opaque in terms of it, more opaque in their guidance. NVIDIA went from, 280 down to 150. Now it's sitting at about 200.
Right.
Why? Because they reset expectations lower. And now people believe that it's all clear. You can invest. And no way is management going to miss a third quarter row. Same thing with Apple. So it's that resetting of expectations lower to a level where people thought the risk was out of it, and let's go into it.
So as I come up on the end of our time here, and I think that's really fascinating. I think that's really interesting about that reset. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking to Steve Weiss, my friend from CNBC, who is Chief Investment Officer and Managing Partner at Short Hills Capital Partners, just one of the wisest, sagest fellows I know on Wall Street, and it is a great honor to have him on here. Steve, as we finish up here, tell us what you think about for the rest of the year and give us, through December, does this melt up continue or do we run into some sort of a storm here?
No, so I don't think there's a storm unless the China deal doesn't happen, but I think that is going to happen. And frankly, if the market traded down significantly on that, I'd be a buyer. Markets go up, 85% of the time. So to pick the point in time where it's going to go down, I think, is a mistake. So I think the market continues to move higher. I was with Rick Rieder from BlackRock on Friday, and he makes a case for the ECB buying equities.
Really?
They've done all they can with credit. Yeah. And if they do that, then it's really off to the races.
So there are there's still a lot of unknown positives that could happen out there, huh?
Right. And you really never know the negatives. Negatives are so much tougher to pinpoint than the positives. I think that the Fed is on hold right now because there's no inflation out there. And even with crude prices going higher, I just don't see the core inflation picking up just yet. So that's really what you have to watch, inflation. And the Fed is on record saying they may let it run a little higher. So that's not a real issue either. So absent some really exogenous event to the markets, I think we're okay. Not that there's not risk out there. There's always risk, and you got to be conscious of that. But you just never know what it is. And that's the definition of market corrections. It's that surprise, it's that December surprise. So I'm positive on the markets.
So you're positive on the markets, and it sounds like it would take an exogenous shock to get you to turn negative at this point. And there's a lot of still room for good news. So a bullish Steve Weiss, even on market highs here on the Farcast. Steve, any final departing thoughts before we let you go? We really appreciate your time. And ladies and gentlemen, this is like having an experienced doctor to talk to you rather than the new freshly minted intern. The new freshly minted intern, you know, has lots of great ideas. This guy has a lot of experience. Listen to Weiss. So as we part today, please give us a couple of final words, and I can't thank you enough for being with us.
No, my pleasure. My only final words would be that I'm bullish. I'm not wildly bullish, and I always keep cash on the sidelines for opportunities. And you never know when you get them. When you get them, you got to be ready to buy into them.
Have a little dry powder is the probably final departing advice, and fabulous advice from my friend Steve Weiss. Thank you so much for being with us on the Farcast. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, we're going to be with the Dan Mahaffey, the great Dan Mahaffey, from the Center for the Study of the Presidency in Congress. When we come back on the Farcast.
You're listening to Farcast.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Farcast. We have a great lineup of upcoming guests. Next week, Kenny Polcari returns to talk markets with Michael. Dan Mahaffey will be with us to make sense of the nonsensical world of D.C., and we are joined by special guest Neil Duane, Chief Global Strategist of Allianz GI. Go beyond the headlines every week with the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world. And now, back to the Farcast and Michael Farr.
You're listening to Farcast. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thank you so much for joining us again this week. What a terrific first segment we had. Steve Weiss, what a terrific guy. I've known him for a long time on CNBC and just so insightful and thoughtful about the markets. Experience matters when you're investing. Matters a lot, like it does, I think, with physicians. A young physician might order a lot more tests. An older physician, more experienced physician, can sort of look and assess and say, I think I know what this is. I've seen this before. Same with Weiss, and just a terrific guy. Really enjoyed having him on the Farcast. I hope you enjoyed it, too. It was terrific. Well, now, we go to Dan Mahaffey, our senior political analyst here at the Farcast from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. He is a Washington insider and a pro's pro when it comes to the world of politics. We've gotten insights for months and years now from Dan. We're so grateful that he's with us every week. Welcome back to the Farcast, Dan.
Good to be back, Michael.
Well, it's been a very interesting week in Washington. I think I've said that every week for a couple of years now. Been a very interesting week in Washington. Somewhere like, I use the word interesting like the Chinese use it, may you live in interesting times, you know, that curse that they make.
Sort of an old curse.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. I've known many old curses throughout my career, and particularly a number of old curses in Washington, D.C. So we are still having fallout from the Mueller report here in Washington. Is it going to go anywhere, Dan? Tell us what you're watching this week. What's on your top of your list?
Well, I think what we saw that was interesting was that the Mueller report has definitely, at least among the Democratic base, brought the impeachment talk back out onto the stage. I think we're also seeing now that this is laid out in a way where you actually get a sense of the scope of Russian interference and really a White House in disarray where perhaps the president was prevented from committing obstruction of justice simply because, as we've seen in other areas, some of his staff and underlings were willing to ignore the orders.
So this has been kind of, I guess, picking up volume here in Washington this week. I thought it would really be dying away more. But now we've got talks of real impeachment again. Is that a possibility?
I think what we're going to see, if not impeachment, though, is continued thorough investigation by the House intelligence committees and judiciary committees looking into the range of factors laid out. We have the subpoena issued for Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, who really sat on President Trump's order to perhaps fire Mueller. And when he sat on that order, that might have been what prevented the push for obstruction of justice. But ultimately, the Mueller report itself is a challenge to Congress, where Mueller is saying, look, the Justice Department guidelines preclude me from indicting a sitting president, and therefore the result is that the judicial remedy for this is for Congress to look into investigations or impeachment. Now, the challenge of that is it's going to be, you know, it's highly partisan atmosphere. So impeachment's no longer the investigatory process that the founders may have once intended it for to be, where Congress could check the judiciary. But I think we're going to start to see more questions of the White House advisors, the lawyers, and ultimately Mueller himself when they are asked to testify before Congress.
I'm hearing that most sort of folks, senior Democratic leadership, think that impeachment would basically just give Trump another opportunity to demonize his accusers. And I think he does that, you know, very well whenever he chooses to do it. And the chance of conviction in the Senate, which is required, is not there. So why give him, you know, why give him the foil to fight against publicly when we've got an election coming up? I mean, that's kind of what I'm hearing. Are you hearing that? And does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me, and I'm hearing the same. I think the best strategy, if I were advising Democrats, would be continue the investigations that aren't impeachment. Look into hush money payments, what they got from Cohen, his tax returns, other advice from Mueller, and keep those keep those investigations on the headlines, but do not go so far as impeachment. Because I also think you mentioned the partisan breakdown in the Senate, as well as the ultimate support that Trump has from his base. The ultimate remedy to this comes in 2020 at the ballot box.
So now, when we think about the 2020 ballot box, it seems, am I right? There are now 20 Democrats who have declared their candidacy for president of the United States.
Yeah, and we're at the point, and we laughed about this during past episodes of that. If you're 35, can fog a mirror and find Iowa, that seems to be the barrier to entry to run as a Democrat in this election.
Biden's supposed to announce this week, right? So we're going to be 21, 22, yeah. 23 candidates. Not everybody's announced yet, right?
Yeah, Biden is there. And you see this sort of top, tiers 1 and 1A forming, where you have Biden, Sanders. I would look at the near tier behind that, Warren. What we've seen with Buttigieg surging, all of these, I think, we'll see shake out in different ways. Can Buttigieg turn this momentum and grow that into a full-fledged campaign movement? How are Warren's policy proposals being received? And then ultimately, does Biden have the energy and the heft, given that this field is looking increasingly diverse and younger?
And so I saw yesterday that Senator Sanders, Bernie Sanders, suggested that prisoners should be able to vote, including the Boston bomber should be able to vote in elections. That would be new. I then saw that Kamala Harris suggested that as president, she would use executive privilege to control guns. And then everybody's favorite, yours and mine, Elizabeth Warren suggested that she would enact a huge, huge tax hike in order to eliminate student debt. Those are the sort of proposals that we're seeing with 20 candidates in the field before Vice President Biden joins. How much more polarizing can you get than prisoners' voting rights, executive orders to control guns, and then pay off all the student debt, no matter what those people signed and agreed to pay back? Don't worry about it. It's a problem. They shouldn't have to.
Well, I think this is where you have a very progressive and perhaps very restive young Democratic base that wants to push forward on momentum that they've seen from others like AOC in the midterms. Democratic socialist policies are increasingly popular. And therefore, you have this Democratic base that is pulling primary debate over to the left. Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and we assume Biden, once he enters, are going to moderate that somewhat. But these issues of, for example, the felons voting issue, how would you pivot that in a way of saying One, too many of these probably progressive activists don't remember how issues of law and order really torpedoed the campaign of Governor Dukakis in 1988. But also, you know, look beyond voting for felons and say, well, what's the actual problem here? And could you actually be looking at reforms to criminal justice, reducing the number of charges that end up with people being incarcerated for long periods of time? That's more centrist than really just throwing out these kind of things that pander to activist elements of the Democratic base.
Buttigieg is starting to take some heat. I mean, I guess that's a good sign. People are starting to take him for him. I mean, people are starting to take him seriously enough to fight with him, or to start to point out his flaws and turn their guns and focus on him. But what I've noticed in that is that it's the Democratic Party that's and the Democratic candidates who are taking shots at Mayor Pete. President Trump hasn't taken any shots at him yet. So this is the everybody stand in a circle for the firing squad, it looks like.
Well, yes, it's a question of when you have this diverse of a field, how damaged is the ultimate nominee going to be? But also, I think a lot of the Democrats who are running against Mayor Pete did not predict that he would have this kind of traction. So they're trying to play catch up as well as quickly dent this momentum that he has from his very successful media appearances.
What are we looking at over the course of the next week? We're kind of running out of time here. I'm thinking that it sounds like, from your opinion, is that the president's legal troubles probably not over?
No, I think they're certainly not over. And I think even with Congress investigating, and what I've heard from legal experts too, the Mueller report and Congress are one thing. He really should continue to be concerned about the Southern District of New York. As well as some of the stuff that the New York State Attorney General is starting to look into about the organization and the finances, the hush money payments, things like that. I think also we are going to at least see more traction on which way these congressional investigations are going to go. Most of the, the members of the House and Senate are traveling or on Easter, Passover recess still. So next week we'll start to see, as everyone gets back into Washington, what gets traction out of the report and where these stories start to head.
I think I saw too that the president has filed suit to stop the release or stop the subpoena of his financial records. Did you see that?
That will be a legal matter, I think, where the law of the tax code says that the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee can request the tax returns of an individual and that they shall be furnished by the Treasury. I think that he's continued to use this excuse that he's under audit, but there are some things clearly that the president does not want people to see about his tax returns.
Are you hearing scuttlebutt in Washington about what that might be?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at it. If one, it might be ego, and it shows that he's far less wealthy and far more indebted than he claims to be. But beyond that, I think we'll also see that the range of tax shelters or tax avoidance strategies that he's used are not exactly what a populist would be doing.
Got it. So it's not going to be pretty. Biden is going to announce this week his offices are set up in Washington. I hear that he's leased a lot of space. He's got wonderful office space. This is now a formality. Do all guns all of a sudden shift from Pete Buttigieg over to Joe Biden? What happens as we go into the summer? And I know we've got to end it up here. Harry's waving at me. I heard we're going to have three or four debates scheduled for the Democrats beginning this June. Mm-hmm. I mean, oh my God! And then they're going to be something like 16 Democratic debates.
We're entering this long haul on the campaign.
You're responding with the same enthusiasm I'm feeling. Oh my God! Just shoot me now.
But when it comes to Biden, I think we need to see how he performs back on the media stage and in the limelight before the candidates decide how much of their attention they want to turn to him.
All right. Coming up this week, anything, Dan? What are we going to look at? What are you watching?
I think let's look at people getting back into town. I think we track to see how some of these security issues we're seeing overseas affect people's perceptions of safety and foreign policy. But beyond that, I think it's a all Mueller all the time, as we continue to see from the news coverage.
Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress and the senior political analyst for the Farcast. We're going to be right back with my great friend, Jay Bryson, chief economist, now acting chief economist for Wells Fargo. He was the chief international economist, one of the smartest guys. I've known Jay for almost 30 years, one of the smartest guys I know. When we come back on the Farcast.
You're listening to Farcast.
Do you have an upcoming function and need a dynamic speaker to engage your audience? You've enjoyed listening to the Farcast, so why not invite Michael Farr to speak at your next event? In addition to hosting the Farcast and serving as president of the advisory firm Farr, Miller, and Washington, Michael is the longest-serving paid contributor to CNBC. He is recognized by audiences, and his presentations on the economic outlook are always well-received. Michael has recently appeared at such venues as the Economic Club of Memphis, the University of Delaware, Matheson Financial Conference, and the YPO-WPO Economic Summit. Add your event to the growing list of organizations who have been informed and captivated by Michael's insights. For more information, or to book Michael for an upcoming event, please email me, Harry Jennings, at hjennings@farmiller.com. Or call me at 202-530-5608.
Now more with Michael Farr and the Farcast.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr here in Washington, D.C. Lovely spring evening here in April. What a great Farcast we've had for you this evening. I'm so excited to have had the guests we've had, and we've saved the best for last, ladies and gentlemen. On the Farcast, you remember, we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. And for the world, who better than Dr. Jay Bryson? Jay is the now acting chief economist for Wells Fargo Securities. He was the chief international economist. I've known Jay Bryson now at least 25 or 30 years. I can't believe it. We were both 12. He is a PhD from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in economics. He has his BA there as well. He's a member of the American Economic Association, the Charlotte Economics Club, the National Association for Business Economics. He was even on their board of directors. I'm a member of NABE as well. That's a great organization. Hey, Jay Bryson, welcome to the Farcast. It is such a great honor to have you on.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's always good corresponding with you.
Well, it's wonderful, and ladies and gentlemen, too, I read Jay Bryson's stuff every day. He doesn't publish exactly every day, but I know I read him every week. If Jay's writing, I'm reading, and I learn so much every time. Jay, as we look, so let's start with the broad economy. As we were coming into December, we had a Fed that was still tightening and much more hawkish than the Fed we had about 3 weeks later in January. And we were seeing economic conditions slow. Give us your view on the U.S. economy and what's happening around the globe.
Well, so, I mean, I guess in general, I would say that things have downshifted a tad here in the United States. I mean, so to kind of give you a sense, back in the second quarter of last year, about a year ago, we grew about 4%. Third quarter, so call it the fall, we're down to 3.5. In the fourth quarter, we're down to just a little bit over 2%. Now, you know, the first quarter number is probably going to be somewhere around 2.5. So, you know, maybe it bounced up a little bit from the fourth quarter, but in general, we're not at that, you know, heady 4% sort of growth rate that we had, you know, roughly a year ago. But still, you know, if you're going to grow 2.5% or so, it's not lights out, but it's, you know, there's certain the economy continues to expand. The unemployment rate remains, you know, at a 50-year low right now. So in general, I think you have to consider that the things in the economy are going reasonably well right now.
So it sounds like we should ignore what we're seeing on that television ad where it says okay is not okay. Maybe with the economy, okay is actually okay is what I'm hearing, huh?
Yeah, I think that it is. You know, there's some volatility. I mean, not only in financial markets, as you well know, but there's going to be a little bit of volatility in the underlying economy as well. You know, any given quarter, It can be choppy in terms of the GDP numbers and the things that are pushing it around. But if you kind of smooth it out, if you look at the kind of the broad trend, you know, in general, the economy continues to expand. You know, if we get to July without a recession, and that seems very, very likely,
yes,
that that's going to happen, it'll become the longest expansion in the post-World War II era. I mean, that, you know, it doesn't get much better than that.
It doesn't get better than that. And so, you know, how long can that go on, Jay? I don't recall seeing any, recession in any of your recent forecasts. When are you forecasting a recession anytime soon?
So we're not. Our forecast goes out to the end of 2020, which is, you know, roughly about as far as you're going to be able to see anyway. And I guess you got to ask yourself, how do recessions happen? So they happen in one of two ways. One is something unexpected comes along. So we're going to give you an example of that. So, you know, those people who are old enough to remember, sadly, I am. But, you know, the OPEC oil shocks of the 1970s.
Yes.
You know, very, very few people saw those things coming. You know, if you go back to 73, in the course of a few months, the price of oil goes up four times.
Yes.
And it puts the economy into a pretty deep recession. Those things, by their very nature, are just essentially impossible to forecast. So we all know the world could change tomorrow. But, you know, we assume that it won't happen until it does. So the other way recessions happen, if you don't have one of these unexpected things happening, is imbalances get built up in the economy over time that you notice. And so, when these imbalances are big enough and with the correction is large enough, it can pull the economy down into a recession. So examples of this would be 10 years ago, housing, 20 years ago, tech. If you go back 30 years ago, it would be too much commercial construction. So you say, all right, look around the economy. Is there anything that's wildly out of balance right
yes.
now? And
yeah.
there's nothing that's kind of wildly out of balance. And so, you know, to kind of get back to your question, how long can this thing go on? It can go on for a while, as long as you don't have one of these sort of unexpected sort of shocks come along that derails the economy.
Talk about the level of debt, if you would, because we have seen since 2007 or 8 or somewhere in there, we've seen the U.S. debt about double. And then we've seen this, whatever we call this expansion of the Fed's balance sheet, which we don't really call debt. I mean, I just sort of think of it as funny money that they've created there to the tune of $4 trillion worth of creation. But what do you think about the debt and the deficits that are deficit spending of $1 trillion a year now should look to be something like $14 trillion in deficit spending over the next 10 years, 9 years? Does that concern you with that debt building? Because I'm looking for bubbles, too. And somehow that much debt worries me. Does it worry you?
So the short answer is it doesn't keep me awake at night worrying about it. Now, I'm not trying to belittle the long-term fiscal challenges that the country faces. And sooner or later, we need to start having an adult conversation about how we're going to deal with some of those long-term challenges. But on the other hand, the reason I don't lay awake at night worrying about it, I mean, to me, it's not a Lehman Brothers that's going to happen in the near term.
Okay.
And the reason why is there's no alternative to Treasury securities. You know, if you are a huge institutional investor, like a central bank or a large pension fund or insurance company or something like that, there's no alternatives to those things. And again, in the long run, you know, can we continue to run these sorts of deficits and have debt going up the way it is? No. But is this going to be something that's going to trigger a recession in the next, you know, year or two or three? I don't think so.
Are you're not an MMT guy, though, are you?
I'm not an MMT guy. I mean, I think that's just asking for trouble, you know, in the long run.
Well, I'm talking about modern monetary theory, folks, which basically says you don't need to worry about debt at all and you don't care about deficits because interest rates are so low it doesn't matter.
Right. And sooner or later, that will come home to the good thing about the United States is we borrow in our own currency.
Yes.
You know, countries that get in trouble, have gotten in trouble in the past, generally are borrowing in somebody else's currency. We borrow in our own sort of currency. And so that's a good thing. Now, can this go on forever? No, it cannot. But again, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have a Lehman Brothers because of too much government debt in the next year or two or even three.
Your expertise is well, you're a fabulous economist and a brilliant economist, but your expertise, at least in the recent past, has been a focus on international economics, global economics. Is there anything, it doesn't sound like you have a real concern domestically, what worries you about the globe right now? What about going, is there anything in the world that kind of has you concerned?
Well, concern's a strong word. So I guess what I, you know, things that
concerned is not my strong word. Worried and screaming into the night is kind of my strength. So I'm presuming okay. You're not there. That's good. We're not.
You know, I'm an economist, so I'm a little bit more low key.
No kidding.
So things that I guess we would be analyzing right now, or you know, kind of looking at things that potentially could be problematic, would be, you mentioned debt.
Yes.
Look around the world. Is there problems with debt out there? Well, let's start with China. There's a lot of debt in the business sector in China. Now, my sense is, our analysis tells us that it's largely a manageable sort of problem. If push comes to shove, the Chinese government has the financial resources to recapitalize its banking system if need be. That said, Chinese economy is not the most transparent economy in the world either. And so perhaps our analysis just could be wrong because of the lack of kind of transparency there. So you know, if there would be a hard landing in China in the next year or two, that would clearly have economic ramifications. Italy has a lot of debt as well. Now, we're not back to where we were a few years ago with the European sovereign debt crisis. There's been a lot of backstops that have been put in place. The ECB has shown a willingness to do what it needs to do, et cetera, et cetera. However, you know, Italy is not Greece. Greece was pretty small. Italy is one of the 10 largest economies in the world. It has €2.5 trillion worth of debt. That's a big number. And so if Italy were to have a major recession and the deficits blow out and people start dumping Italian government bonds, that could have some financial repercussions in the rest of the world as well.
Okay, so we do have a couple of areas of concern, but it sounds like relatively you think that they're somewhat manageable.
I think in general, yeah, Michael, I think in they are manageable at this point. And I think we still have a pretty constructive view of the economy, you know, let's call it in the next 2 years or so. You know, once you get out beyond that, it's face it, you know, any sort of economic forecast is pretty much worthless.
Yeah.
That far out. But, you know, for the foreseeable future, for between now and, say, the end of 2020, assuming one of these, you know, major unforecastable sort of exogenous shocks doesn't happen, yeah, I think the economy continue to expand here.
Okay, I have a thesis that I want to try on you. And I, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot really convey to you the level of hubris necessary on my part to actually posit an economic theory in front of Jay Bryson publicly, okay? But if you'll ride with me and know that I have no shame, here it is, Jay. I am actually pretty encouraged by the wage gains that I'm seeing in the employment data. Even as weak as they are, I think that what we have seen in this economic recovery that's been driven, in my opinion, by central banks and a lot of monetary policy and easing and things around the world, has not led to any sort of significant growth in demand. And in fact, we could increase supply, and what we haven't had in this economic recovery is a demand-led recovery. And so with these wage gains, finally we're beginning to see some more cash in the hands of the middle-class Americans, and in an economy that's 70%, you know, made up of the consumer, of the U.S. consumer, that middle class for a number of years hasn't seen wage gains. That they're beginning to tells me that perhaps we might begin to see a real organic recovery if the Fed doesn't kill it. And I'm hoping that they will be a little bit more patient, because I believe that the Fed knows how to tame inflation. I don't think they know how to get it started, and I think they've been perplexed as to why we haven't had more of it. But God, when they start to see it, I hope they'll let it run a little bit. So there are about three things there I'm asking you to comment on. First, you know, feel free to tell everybody how stupid you think I might be. But also, am I on the right track in finding some encouragement with these wage gains? And if things start to improve, what are the odds the Fed will not kill it?
So the first thing I would say there is you're not stupid at all. I mean, I think, you know, what you just talked about there is very spot on. We are starting to see, I mean, so for roughly two decades or so, real median income. So this is inflation adjusted income,
yes.
Purchasing power,
yes.
If you will, at the median level was stagnant.
Yes.
And so we don't have data yet for 2018, but both in 16 and 17, you started to get see some pretty good gains in terms of real income, median income. And so that's encouraging because that does make the economy a little bit more, or it makes it more, the expansion more sustainable.
Right.
The more broad-based it is, the more sustainable it can become. So that's a good thing. You know, in terms of the Fed, I guess what I would say is there's a study that's going on in the Fed right now in terms of their inflation targets and things like that. And they're not done with this thing yet, but it does seem like, you know, they've had this like 2% sort of objective. And they've come in below that almost every year during this during this expansion. And what they may move to is some sort of average, targeting inflation over some sort of average period of time or a broader sort of range. I mean, the point here is if inflation goes above 2%, they're not going to get spooked. Now, if it were to go to 3.5 or something like that, then you could start to see a lot more tightening. But the point, Michael, here is that even if we start to see the inflation rate start to clip up a little bit to 2.25, 2.5, I don't think the Fed, at least under its current leadership structure, I don't think they're going to get all that spooked. And so I think I'm not saying that the Fed can't tighten again in the next year or so, but I think the hurdle to do so, I think, is pretty high.
What would you do differently if you were a governor, a voting member of the Open Market Committee right now? If you were on the Fed, would you do anything different? Do you like what Jay Powell's doing? Are they on the right course? What would you change?
Yeah, I think in general they are. I mean, I think that if you can criticize the Fed at any point at this point, I think it's the kind of the communication strategy that's going on there. You know, are they, every time the market has a hiccup, or is the Fed going to be talked down from that? We don't really know. I mean, we saw that happen in December.
We did.
But you don't necessarily want markets, you know, dictating monetary policy. But I think part of it is there is a search for, as I was saying, kind of a new operating framework, if you will, in terms of its inflation. And I think once they settle on that and they start to figure out a way to communicate that to the public, then perhaps some of these questions about what the Fed's going to do is going to start to go away.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is my friend, Dr. Jay Bryson, who is the acting chief economist for Wells Fargo Securities. One of the smartest guys I know, was an economist in the International Finance Division at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. He's been a professor of economics. Just one of the smartest guys I know. And I'm going to suggest something here on the Farcast, and I am going to repeat it often on CNBC. I was on NPR today, and I forgot to do this, Jay, and I apologize, but I will do this henceforth. Jay Bryson is the right guy for the Federal Reserve governorship. I am absolutely serious. Jay Bryson, Steve Moore is now out. The president doesn't have a nominee. So we're going to start it now on the Farcast. If you want to make, Mr. President, if you want to do the right thing for this country and the right thing for the Federal Reserve and the U.S. economy, Jay Bryson is your next nominee for the Federal Reserve. There, Far said it. Jay, I hope you'll accept the nomination because the country needs you.
Well, thank you, Michael. And if it were to come to pass, I guess that would get me back to Washington, and our wives could get together again like they did years ago, and we'd all have a good time together in Washington.
Wouldn't that be fun? And I could go to the Fed for lunch, which I haven't done in a long damn time. That'd be pretty fun. Jay Bryson, thank you so much for being on the Farcast. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us again this week. It's been a terrific Farcast. We appreciate your notes. We appreciate your texts and your tweets. We really do. Thank you so much for letting us spend a little time in your offices, in your homes, and in your earbuds while you're on the trail or on the elliptical machine. We are very, very grateful. Thank you so much. We'll be back again next week in Washington, D.C. For the Farcast, I'm Michael Farr.
Thank you for listening to the Farcast. We're always happy to hear from you. You can reach us at farcast@farmiller.com. We'd like to remind you that if you think you've heard a recommendation to buy or sell any security this week, you haven't. Farcast is for informational purposes only, and we hope that you find the information useful. But before you make any investing decision, we always recommend that you do your research and discuss with your financial advisor. If we can be of any help at Farr Miller in Washington, please give us a call at 202-530-5600 or email us at invest@farrmiller.com.